It is Friday, March 11th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or its board, the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation. Today on Geek Speak, we're taking your calls of questions and comments about technology. That's the second half of the show. And the phone number is here to take them down, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about 20 minutes. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta, and Drew Meyer, Storage Specialist at AdaptTech. We also have, via internet, or attempting to have, I should say, Dee Dee Hubbard from New York, who will join us, I think, momentarily. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning, Lyle.
Oh, my goodness. Say that again, Drew.
Good morning, Lyle. I'm
shouting over.
There we go.
Good morning,
everybody. I think I'm actually awake now. Okay. So we're going to start with some news before we do our taking people's calls and questions and email and such. So we'll start with just a little bit of geek news. I'm going to go ahead and go with Sean. You look like you've got paper in front of you. What you got?
Yes, this crossed the desk this morning. That makes it sound big, doesn't it? So Samsung has developed a 7-megapixel camera phone.
Wow.
7 megapixels. Ooh. That's big. That's big and new.
That's about as nice as your camera, Lyle, isn't it?
It's better.
So what does that mean to me as a consumer?
So the Samsung SCH-V770 was just shown at CeBIT, which is probably the world's largest electronic show, computer show, happening in Hanover, Germany right now. This camera takes the same form factor as their last 3-megapixel model. This thing will easily fit in your pocket. It's kind of like a candy bar size form factor. It has a 2-inch display on the rear that offers 320 by 240 pixel resolution. And, can take quite a high-quality picture. 7 megapixels.
Now, the lens on this, I guess, is just a little tiny pinhole lens?
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah.
See, that's
so it's
so
not going
to
be as good as yours.
It's so strange to me that people spend so much energy on getting that megapixel up when you're talking about, you won't have a focus range. You won't have a lot of things a camera can do.
This thing actually has a 3x optical zoom lens.
Okay, so it actually does have extension.
Yeah.
All right.
Does that mean the pictures are larger when you take them? The size of the picture files?
Oh, yeah, they're going to be massive at 7 megapixels.
Yeah, so whoever buys that's got to think about their media.
Sean, I'll go ahead and ask you some questions you don't know. Does it have a RAW file format support?
Oh, God. Who knows?
The answer to that is Toshiba.com, right?
I don't know. Samsung.
Samsung
SCH-V770. I'm sure they're probably plastered all over their website right now because it's probably their coolest device at CeBIT. And, of course, they are also featuring... Maybe this is as cool, too.
Yeah, go
the
ahead.
Samsung SGH-I300 offers 3-gigabyte hard drive. A hard drive and a cell phone.
3 gigabyte.
3 gig, one of the little micro IBM drives?
Yeah.
Oh,
little micro drives. It also has
Wait. Does the one with the giant camera in it?
No.
How do you store the pictures? You take like two and you're out of room?
And this one has a 1.3 megapixel camera.
That's really strange.
So you can take thousands of pictures without erasing them. Kind of weird. It also has the 3x. No, it doesn't have any zoom. Yeah, that's weird.
Well, a hard drive and a cell phone.
As soon as they combine those two phones, look out.
Wow. Thank you, Sean, for
incredibly
that.
Incredibly useful event.
We'll go with Drew, your first story for the day.
Let's see. This week there's been a lot of discussion around the SCO group and delisting from the NASDAQ. And
I saw that.
It's been kind of the upshot that I've managed to gather over a number of articles this week is that the controversy around the Linux suit that they brought against IBM is sort of dying down, and IBM's court case has been pushed out yet again sometime in 2006. And the analysts that are and the authors that are writing these articles are now kind of coming to consensus that if SCO is still alive by the time that court case gets to court, is it going to matter anymore? And nobody really is concerned about this anymore.
Yeah,
it's fascinating because a year ago it was a huge deal.
Yeah, a little background. SCO, which actually used to stand for Santa Cruz Operations, it's based the same place the KOSP is based. Unix company made really good secure operating system.
Yeah, they were bought by Caldera.
And then they were bought by Caldera,
which was a Linux company.
Because SCO had such a base market, if you will, in Unix, it had a lot of patents and such. Caldera snatched it up and then started suing companies that were doing Linux development. Of course, everyone knows that Linux itself, a Unix kind of derivative, if you will, is a completely open source package. So the idea of copyright infringement, basically they were trying to attack this kind of open source idea, and they've done well at taking people to court, but not well at getting any judge to listen to them. And it looks like they're possibly
isn't a caldera like a
running out of time.
A spent volcano hole or something it's like a smoking
it's
volcano
a crater,
hole.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right, that's right.
Huh, oh boy, interesting. Yeah, with a cratered SEO.
Well, thank you, Drew, for that. I'm going to go to Dee Dee. Dee Dee, welcome to GeekSpeak. No, we're still working on that whole technology thing. Gosh, technology is so confusing, isn't it?
That's why you have a hard drive in your cell phone, right?
I guess so.
So useful.
So. All right, so we're going to go with Sean then.
Yeah, last week we had somebody call that asked us about Intel cores. Remember code names? He threw a bunch at us and we're like, yeah. Well, we decided to ask our Intel buddies for some information on their upcoming processors, and they sent me a decoder ring.
Ooh.
This
wow.
is just like,
we should put that on the side.
Yeah, two pages of code names and what they mean.
So Nocoma and Copperhead. And
yeah, Demona, Millington, Montecito, Montville, Paxville.
Intel.
Okay.
So this is all their chips coming out. They announced them at IDF, disclosed them at
Sean,
IDF.
Sean, spit that my way, and I'll get up on GeekSpeak.
Yeah, we'll get that up on the site. It's pretty cool.
Any of them about projects that you didn't know about that were happening at Intel?
You know, there's so many here. I haven't really had a chance to look at them really closely, but a lot of the dual core stuff is here. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested to see how that works.
Well, you're at a processor manufacturing company. Transmeta does processors as well. Anything in that you can breeze through real quick to see that it's going to be competing with Transmeta, for example?
Yeah. None of this will be competing with Transmeta.
Okay, good to know.
Because Transmeta is moving into intellectual property now.
Oh, that's right. Well, maybe we'll talk about that in the near future. Sean, thanks for that. Yeah. Drew, I'm going to go back to you.
Well, Sean just mentioned the IDF, the Intel Developer Forum, and I was there in capacity for Adaptec working on storage. We were demonstrating some of the first serial-attached SCSI, or SAS, drives and controllers and enclosures for storage that are coming to market here soon. And the fact that SAS is real, or that serial attached SCSI is, the products are in design, off the drawing board and into prototypes and being actually used, is kind of a big deal for the storage industry. This really doesn't affect consumers much, I wouldn't say. There are really three or four different styles of drive interface today. Most people are familiar with ATA or IDE, which is what all of us have today. And then the newer consumer-level drive is called SATA, or serial ATA, followed by SCSI, which is a higher level of performance and a higher level of reliability, and that's an older bus, which is now being followed up or replaced with serial-attached SCSI, or SAS.
So SCSI is basically going the same direction as ATA IDE went with
yes,
the serial.
Yes, and so you're getting tremendous performance. These are drives that are designed to be running in machines available 24/7, 365, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year round, with superb performance, seek times in less than 4 milliseconds, which is significantly better than a serial ATA drive or a SATA drive.
Right. Well, and does that take into account the queuing that the SCSI can do for the operating system?
The SAS protocol includes all of the benefits of the SCSI protocol and the native command queuing, et cetera. But the major advantages are that you can scale devices much further now. You can attach up to 16,000, theoretically, 16,000, more than 16,000 devices onto one SCSI controller.
That's good. So that'll help you out, Sean, at home. I mean, you're up to what, 4,000 devices?
That's right.
And a lot of them are in my closet because I can't hook them up. So.
Right, cause yeah. So this won't help you at all because all that's old technology.
Yeah, that's right.
Drew, well, let's talk real briefly since you're here. And, Sean, you just tried out the 4200 from Adaptec, the Snap appliance that uses, now this is a different type of SCSI protocol, SCSI over IP or iSCSI. Sean, what do you think of it?
It's pretty cool.
All right.
Yeah.
It worked, huh? That's great news.
It worked great. So basically you go in through using a web interface on this network attached drive.
Right.
I set up an iSCSI drive.
This loud network attached drive. That thing is big and loud.
It's, but it was it's big.
It's not really designed for your
home,
bedroom, is it?
Yeah. No. It's only, more of only geeks put it in their bedroom. Yeah.
It's like a jet engine next to your pillow.
Yes. So, this is more of this of the Soho variety. This is more of the small office instead of home office.
Right, right.
But, yeah, this thing is pretty cool. I set up the iSCSI drive. What that does is it kind of converts the drive so that you can't access it through the network resources anymore. It converts it to another type of drive. And using a client interface, I downloaded the Microsoft iSCSI client. It found it right away and it connected to it. And then what you do is you go into appears like a local hard drive.
Okay. Very cool.
And so then I just went in and formatted it.
But let's be clear.
Why'd
this
you
device,
bother?
You're only connecting this device via an Ethernet card. And actually, you plugged it into your network, which happened to be a 100 megabit network,
unfortunately.
So you had to get restricted to that. But it actually supports gigabit.
Yeah.
So you plug it into your Ethernet network. And then when you launch this iSCSI utility from Microsoft, or there's ones for Apple product as well, you actually see it as something that you can connect to as a local drive. And then no one else accesses it.
And you can set it up so you see it locally all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's transparent.
If it was gigabit, you're dealing with gigabit.
If I were in gigabit Ethernet, it would have been awesome. I just don't have a gigabit switch. Uh-huh. So the only reason I tried is because I wanted to see how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Well, why did you bother doing this? What was the problem you had? And why did having it show up as a local drive make any difference to you?
Well, I recently got a NetCell SCSI card. And this is a card in and of itself. And I've got three 250 gig serial ATA drives and hooked it up to this card. And then I created a RAID, a RAID.
RAID 5?
5 type SCSI array.
They call it
RAID XL. Yeah.
Okay.
Where I'm access, two of the drives become one large 500 gig drive, and the other drive is a parity drive. So what happens is while I'm using these drives, one of the drives goes down, no big deal. I still have all my data.
You have to shut down, and then you put in another 250 on the dead drive.
Not shut down at all. It just keeps running.
Right, but I mean, to fix the problem, you'd have to shut down the machine.
Yeah, because serial ATA is not plug and play. Right.
Unplug the one that's broken, plug in a new one,
and then I
start
just
it up
continue.
And it will, Okay, so
but I don't have to shut down right away.
Right.
I won't even know the difference, except something will come up and say, oh, one of your hard drives died. So anyway, the drives I was using now, I was using these drives individually.
Right.
I had to get all the data off these drives so I could create the RAID array and then move the data back.
And that's where the adapter came in.
That's where the adapter came in, yeah. Right. It worked out really well. So we'll try and get something up on the site about that, just describe what iSCSI is. I think we should at least do that.
It's pretty interesting stuff.
Oh, cool.
Thank you, Sean, for that. And, Didi, I'm going to try to go to you again. You there? Of course, there's a delay through the Internet to New York.
I don't know if you saw the email from her.
Oh.
The servers are down.
Right, no, I got that. We're actually chatting through Fire. We're connected right now through Skype. I'm not sure exactly where we're not connecting through audio, but we're speaking through text. And
maybe you should tell people what Skype is.
Sure.
Yeah.
Skype
is Didi with us from New York?
Well, she's not, actually. I'm going to hang up and reconnect with her. Maybe that will do it. You can hear me operating that. So now I'm ringing her.
This is over the Internet.
That's right.
So from your computer.
It's an application that uses Internet protocol to make audio connections. So my machine is encoding the audio and sending it that way, and hers is encoding it and sending it my way, and we can hear each other. We've done this for about a month and a half or so.
Yeah, anybody can do this, right?
That's right.
It's
Skype's
a free piece of software.
Skype happened to go down earlier today. There were some problems. It's of course, there's a small company, and they're trying to get bigger, and they're pretty popular in a lot of ways. It's fun to be able to make a free phone call. Of course, both people have to have computers. So it's kind of like Internet telephony, but it doesn't have the hardware that normally deals. Didi, you can go ahead and start speaking if you do pick up. I'd love to hear from you. Well, we're gonna keep going with the geek news, and we'll go back to Drew, please.
Ooh,
sir.
Ooh, I've got a great story. I ran across this yesterday, and I was surfing around and randomly, and I've forgotten how I ran across it. But the story is extraordinary. It's the website, the URL to read about it is called Pacific T, that's the letter T, .com.
Dee Dee, you are on. I'll get to you in just a second after Drew's story. Please go on.
So PacificT.com, that's the letter T, and then /story. And this is called the Graphing Calculator Story. And it's a story about two engineers at Apple, one engineer at Apple who was laid off while he was working on a project in the 80s and was so fired up and excited about his project that he decided to keep coming to work. The guy had enough savings that he could keep going along. He didn't have to have the income. And his badge never got turned off, so he walked into the building every day. And ultimately, through a period of years, this continued. Other people in the company found out about it, started getting really excited about this Skunk Works project that was happening under the radar completely, contributed resources, people, engineering talent, techniques, and coding to the project, until ultimately the whole thing came to fruition, came to the light of day, shipped on the Apple Goldmaster CD to their manufacturing facility, and the software made it into the final release.
But it wasn't sanctioned or sponsored at all by Apple.
Nor was it funded. Completely under the radar, which it's really exciting to me. And that's nothing bad about Apple. It just happens that Apple was the company to do that, and it sort of falls in line that inspirational people and products kind of come from that company.
So this person, are they working for Apple again now or not?
There were really two developers finally that did this, and they currently don't work for Apple. They maintained the software product that they created. And Pacific Tea is their website where you can read about what they do today. Anyway, it was pretty interesting. Maybe is that the internet?
Yeah, I think that feed is coming through Dee Dee, I believe. I think we're going to...
Sound like a street cleaner.
Yeah, it did.
It sounded like a lawnmower.
New York.
Yeah.
So they basically have their own company now and are being pretty successful with supporting this product.
Correct. They have their own I don't know how successful they are. That's the website that they have, and that's where the story is. And actually, I read about it on Slashdot, and it's just amazing because on March 11th, 1994, the front page of the New York Times business section had an article about this whole thing with the two guys. And naturally, since they didn't work for Apple, nobody in Apple PR was aware of this sudden publicity that came up on the page.
That's great.
They didn't have to talk to anybody about it. They just did it.
It's a great story. It's kind of fun that they did that. I'm wondering how much ownership the groups have, because, of course, Apple was supporting it unbeknownst to them.
Ultimately, they worked out a reverse licensing deal with Apple so that it's all straight with the legal folks. But that really wasn't the point of it, and that's the part that gets me excited that... He believed so strongly in what he was doing and the value he was adding that couldn't be stopped.
That's
right,
amazing.
Right. Sean, I'm going to go to you, sir.
Okay, I'd like to have been there the day they found out what was going on.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Who are you? Oh, they ran into places where the facilities people would come to clean out their cubes, and they weren't supposed to be there. And then there was a layoff, so they came in the next day, and suddenly there were tons of cubes available, so they just relocated. No one ever knew. It's just like under the wire the whole time.
Sean?
So at Intel Developer Forum, there was this really interesting... session with Gordon Moore, who is the guy who came up with Moore's Law, which in the next few months, April 19th, is the 40th anniversary of that.
And basically, has processor speed been doubling every 18 months?
Actually, he wrote an article for Electronics Magazine, and his observation was that it would double every 24 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I guess it's more like 18 months now. But in the future, it's going to be longer. Could be 3 to 4 years. So what's happening is people are saying nanotubes and nanoelectronics are going to replace, you know, silicon, and that the number of transistors isn't going to matter anymore. And Gordon Moore says, bollocks to that. Basically, he said, replacing digital silicon is going to be very difficult. We have a cumulative couple of $100 billion invested in R&D, and that's going to be very difficult to overthrow, especially on mass production scale. They can make these nanotube type chips now, but no way they could do it, you know, make millions of those a quarter. And then he also had some other cool observations. He said that, look for China. The fact that China is beginning to produce 10 times the number of engineers that the United States is going to really make them play a heavy role.
And, of course,
role.
They don't have the massive infrastructure in China that are creating tons of chips.
They don't yet.
So they're going to be building the newest stuff. So yeah. We might be seeing all the nanotube technology chips in mass production in China.
Who knows? He said Silicon Valley is still a great place to start a company, but it's expensive, especially for housing.
Mm.
Or business location.
Yeah. He said, of course, expect the number of transistors in the chip to double maybe every 3 to 4 years. He said, but still, the industry has always blown past barriers in the past, so who knows? Maybe they'll continue on this ramp. And this is kind of interesting. He said, human intelligence, in my view, is something that is done in a dramatically different fashion than von Neumann computers.
Don't get me started.
So the brain processes in a highly parallel and relatively sloppy fashion, but one that is well-suited for its purposes.
Because we're sloppy minds. So that's more of Moore's Law. And I guess he's still listened to quite a bit about his predictions and such because of that famous one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I'm going to go back to Drew, sir. Actually, you know, we'll try Dee Dee again because, you know, we failed so many times we might as well give it a shot again. Dee Dee, you with us? And no. Drew, go ahead, sir.
I should elaborate on my von Neumann architecture grunt there.
Yeah.
The, there's an interesting story. My brother went to the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia where they invented or where they first produced ENIAC, the first vacuum tube-based computer that really became the introduction, the first successful computer that was used for calculating. It was designed for military use. But the two guys that invented it are called Eckert and Mauchly, and nobody knows those names, which is kind of astonishing when you think of all the pioneers in the computer industry. Everybody knows who most of the people are, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and on and on. Nobody's ever heard of Eckert and Mauchly because this guy von Neumann took some of their ideas and published them in a paper, and there's significant discussion over who really had the ideas first and who got to market and proved that they could be
useful. So we talk about the von Neumann computer, which is basically what we consider a computer now.
Yeah.
It's based on
Eckert and Mauchly.
It's actually Eckert and Mauchly.
I'm a fan of the underdogs there.
And Drew, have you gone to the Tech Museum in San Jose?
I've been there, yeah. We used to have some.
They definitely talk about them. It's a great environment.
Good. They deserve it. They did a lot of hard work. Anyway, wireless USB set to kill off Bluetooth. At the IDF forum, there were some samples of a new technology called wireless USB. And if you're not familiar with Bluetooth, it's a wireless technology designed to create PAN networks or personal area networks, typically connecting your cell phone and, say, an earpiece that's worn that there's no wire between them, or your cell phone and your computer so you can synchronize them together.
Or your cell phone into your car.
Right, so you can talk over your car stereo. And I've had a little experience with it. It's sort of cutting edge, and in my experience, it's been a real pain. It's not simple to use.
It hasn't really gotten there.
It had great promise conceptually, but the execution, in my opinion, sort of fell.
Good thing Chris Dunphy's not here.
Well, Sean, you're successfully using Bluetooth all the time, so let's talk about
the
benefits. What's the benefits of Bluetooth from your perspective?
Hands-free.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. But
that's not limited to Bluetooth. It's the hands-free part that you like.
Yeah. Bluetooth, yeah, I got to say, you know, we covered Bluetooth a lot at Maximum PC Magazine in the early days. It was always the promise of Bluetooth.
Right.
And they always said they would have something for us to play with, and they never did. I mean, that technology took years and years to come about.
What's so frustrating is that when you do see it work, like you've got the new Prius from Toyota, and you've got a cell phone that uses Bluetooth.
Yeah, it works great.
You're able to do it pretty easily. You connect, basically have your cell phone sitting in the car, and everything's on the...
I keep it in my pocket, and I answer the phone off my steering wheel.
Right, so you never really take your hands off.
No,
that's
cool. A lot safer, of course.
Yeah.
That's cool, right. But then I also have, you know, I got my laptop in front of me that's got Bluetooth. I've never used it. I've got a video camera, a Sony video camera that's got Bluetooth. I don't know why
I've got a Plantronics earpiece that goes with my cell phone, too.
Oh, that works, too?
I never use it.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Why? Oh, because
you always use the car.
I'm in the car. When I'm walking around, I'd just rather pull my cell phone out and put it to my head and use it.
Right.
But the earpiece, I don't know. It just seems like to walk around with that thing in your head, you know?
The thing that's interesting, though, is you see the good cases, the case where I kept, that makes sense. It's not that, you know, amazing. Like, okay, your cell phone turns into a car phone. Well, car phones were first anyway. I mean, it's not...
Right.
Of course people want to use it that way. So there's that regard. And then what else do people want to use personal area networks
for? Well, I think what people were hoping for was Bluetooth... mice and keyboards,
kind of stuff.
But the thing is, you have to buy a Bluetooth adapter at that point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And those are $20-$30 for one. I've got one. It's very small. It's USB Bluetooth device.
Do you have any USB keyboards or mice?
No.
Yeah. See,
I just use it to sync my cell phone to my computer.
I'm wondering if
wireless USB
will supersede it, simply because, not because the technology is better or anything like that, but simply because there's kind of this Bluetooth. It's kind of a buzz instead of a product.
But Bluetooth, when you buy Bluetooth adapters, typically USB.
Right.
So that's wireless USB.
Yeah.
It already has more, you know, there's more devices that are going to connect to it because it's Bluetooth.
Right.
The speeds are really good, 480 megabits per second, which is stronger than Bluetooth. And
actually, no, that's pretty cool. Because if you've got an external hard drive, that kind of makes for an interesting proposition.
You could have you'd be able to walk into the room and automatically connect to your drive without
you'd have
ever
your drive sitting across the room, where it's not
in.
As loud, you know.
Sure,
That's kind of cool.
Dee Dee chimes in with text from New York. She's really hungry. Of course, it's later there in New York. And she uses Bluetooth all the time. So at least there's, you know, hit people like New York, like Dee Dee, who's using Bluetooth all the time. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland, Drew Meyer, and potentially Dee Dee if we ever figure it out.
This week on This American Life, should I stay or should I go? Get to know people teetering at the crux of this difficult question and find out what leads them to stay put or take the plunge. That's This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m., right after Car Talk on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Geek Speak. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the Internet. Visit geekspeak.org. Click on Contact Us. We're taking your calls and questions about any technology. But we'll cover, the people in the room can handle Windows questions and Mac questions and probably some Unix and some hardware questions. So, you know, you got a problem, give us a ring. The lines are open. 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And you can send us email if you'd like by going to geekspeak.org and clicking on Contact Us. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing Internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland and Drew Meyer. Join the conversation, 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or use the Internet, visit geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us. That 800 number only works in California. We've got calls, so we're going to go to them, because why not, right? That's what we're here for. Actually, I haven't been prompted on them. I'll wait just a little bit longer, but there's still some space open on the lines. We'll do one more news story. Sean, I think I'm going to go with you, sir.
So Microsoft gave details about the new Xbox. Interested in that?
Yeah, game inbox. Yeah,
so, not hardware details. Everybody wants to hear about the hardware details, but they did say that they will have high definition content, which is kind of cool. If you own an HDTV, you can play high def games. They'll look beautiful. It'll have an integrated media browser so you can surf the internet, and so you can make microtransactions for in game purchases. That's right. Xbox has a whole revenue plan around its next version. While you're playing games, you could go shop and buy new game levels, including weapons, cars, character outfits for your digital character.
Wow. So I'm got my credit card in one hand and my mouse and keyboard in the other hand, and I'm flying along, and I need a new something.
Yeah, you could just pop out and say, God, you know, everyone's shoving in this level. I need to go spend $15 so I can buy it, too. And you go do it, and then you're in.
Wow. I feel their hand in my pocket right now.
Are you guys both going to get Xbox 2s?
No.
I have an Xbox. I never play it.
Yeah, sad. No.
All right, from Watsonville.
PC games are just so great.
Yeah, they are. Well, especially when you maintain a machine as well as you do. From Watsonville, Judith, welcome to Geek Speak. All right. Who is online, too?
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Hi, this is Thomas.
Thomas from Bonnie Doon. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question?
Hey, listen, I've been a Mac user for a long time, you know, and because of my business, the software that I got for my business is for a PC, you know. So I went and bought a PC laptop, and I'm also a writer. And I went to copy this novel I'm working on onto a CD. Then I wanted to put it in my my laptop, you know.
Uh-huh.
And my laptop wouldn't bring it up and said that it had a virus. So my question is, how do I get rid of a virus on my Macintosh? Can I get software for that, or is that something that I got to take in and have done, you know, at a shop?
Okay, well, the virus we're probably talking about, the virus we're probably talking about is a Word macrovirus. That's the only kind of virus that a Macintosh machine can give to a Windows machine, if you will. And
okay.
Since you're dealing with a Word document, that makes sense that that's what it is.
That's what it is, a Word document.
It is a Word document. It was created in a Mac version of Word.
That's right.
And
okay.
you're opening it with a PC version of Word.
Right.
Okay, well, there are any virus protection software that you can install on a Mac. The University of California, where I work in the arts division, we use, I believe, a product called, now I'm blanking on it. I'll look it up.
Is it a Norton?
You could get Norton. Basically, any virus protection software is going to get rid of these macroviruses, these Word macroviruses. Now, the problem is that CD you've burned, copied over, that one's going to have that virus on there.
Right.
It should be able to cleanse that virus from that file. What virus protection software do you have on your Windows machine?
What's that? I'm using a Norton Symantec.
Okay, that's a good one.
2005.
And when it says you've got a problem, there's a virus on this, what does it offer for solutions?
It won't let me bring it up. It won't let me load it on.
Okay, if you want to be...
Because you have a virus and we're not going to let you open this file onto this computer, basically.
Okay, so if you want to be tricky and a little geeky, kind of hack the solution... Do this. This sounds really silly, but do this. Disable your virus protection on your Windows machine. Do not open that file. Copy that file to your desktop or something on your Windows machine. Turn your virus protection software back on. Eject your CD. Turn your virus protection software back on. Scan your desktop. Norton will then possibly try to fix that file for you. See,
uh-huh.
It can't fix the file on the CD because it's a write-only medium at this point.
Right.
So it can't actually change the file. But if you get it onto your system, then it will possibly cleanse it.
Okay, but how do I go back, on the Mac?
The Mac, you've got to get a virus protection software on the Mac. There's actually, I know that there's solutions for getting rid of these macros. You could attempt to open up Word on your Macintosh environment and turn off macros and try to disable the macros. And it's possible that by disabling the macros, they won't run anymore, and then you have to remove them from that file.
Uh-huh.
One alternative for you, and this is probably the simplest solution, is if the Mac's not being affected by this macro very much, then simply just copy the contents of your Word document into a text file and send the text file to your Windows machine. That's
uh-huh.
the cheapest and simplest solution.
Yeah, but it's going to lose all its formatting that way.
You will lose all your formatting.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of concerned, too, that, if it's on this, it's like a, 300-page document, it may be in other documents, too, on my Mac. And so
that's a very good concern.
I think I'd be smarter just to kind of get some kind of software where I could run it on all my files on the Mac.
I'd agree with that 100%.
Why are you moving from the Mac to the PC again?
Because this, I also have a business in which the software...
PC software.
...that is available for my business only is on the PC format.
So you're really... you've got an antivirus for the PC already.
I do for the PC, right.
So you're going to have to put some cash out on one for the Mac.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if you do that, then you know you're covered either way, any which way you go.
Exactly. Now, is there a program that you guys think is better than others that I could go ahead and load on there, on the Mac?
No. Any of the virus protection software is going to be pretty good. I like Norton on the Windows machine.
Okay, no, I've got that there.
Right, so go ahead and buy Norton for the Mac.
They have a flavor for each one.
Okay, and then that'll just kind of walk me through the process, will it, when I load it on?
Oh, yeah, when you install the Symantec Norton antivirus on the Mac, it's just like installing any other piece of software.
If you buy the boxed version, you should get a rescue disk with it, right? A bootable
rescue
disk?
Or at least they'll give you instructions
on the boxed version.
You might want to do that, boot off the rescue disk and try and clear it that way.
Oh, okay.
Good luck.
So anyway, I just go to any Mac software dealer, tell them I need an antivirus software.
That's right.
Any idea what that's going to cost?
Under $30.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
You can go to Symantec.com or check there first if you want.
Yeah, go to Symantec.com and see what they have for the products,
all
and
right.
You can buy it online.
Okay, thank you very much,
Thomas,
for that. Now, I got another question, while you guys were talking about Bluetooth.
Okay, quickly, go ahead.
I am a home inspector, so I bought this... This laptop PC to be able to take out on the job, okay? And then I bought this really nice little portable Canon copier to go with it. And so I can just, like, say I come out to your house, for example, and I do an inspection on your house. Then I run my software, and then I want to copy out, this report to give to you on site. So I've been trying to get everything to work with Bluetooth, So I bought a Bluetooth adapter for the PC laptop, and then I have one for the Canon printer also.
Do you get
but
it
I'm
to work
having
okay?
a hard time getting it all to work together.
Yeah, that's what I hear about Bluetooth too.
And I'm just wondering, because I'm a very low-end computer guy, you know, and I'm just wondering, am I smarter just forgetting about all that and then just, you know, running the computer on battery power and then just hooking up a USB cord to the printer?
Probably easier, yeah.
It'll work, we can tell you that.
Yeah, it'll work, because I've got, you know, battery power for the printer too. So I'm totally cordless there as far as that goes.
You sounds like you're going to be a regular geek file.
I hope not. But anyway, you think I'm smarter just kind of getting rid of all that stuff and just going with a cord?
Might be, yeah.
Yeah, if you want it to work reliably,
it'd be simpler.
You're going to use more power, too, because you got to power the Bluetooth transmission.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I see.
Good luck.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye, Thomas. All right, we're kind of... we're going to give it a shot. I think we're with Judith. Judith, are you there from Watsonville?
Hi, yeah.
Hi, Judith.
Hi. I had a question. I write some of my own music, and I sometimes record it. I have iBook, and I record it on GarageBand, and then I can also get it into my iTunes files.
Right on.
And I was wondering, some of it I'd like to be able to share with some friends, and I didn't know whether there's any way of emailing digital copies of any of the music, or if it's complicated to somehow post it.
Not complicated to post it. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Do you have let me ask two questions, Judith. Do you have a website today?
No, I don't. I have a .Mac account, and think I can...
You actually do have a website.
I guess I haven't done anything with it, but I think I have the option of...
There's two ways you could possibly share the music you're making. You could, of course, save the copy of... all the different files you're using and of this file that defines that layout. And then they could edit it as well. But if you just want them to listen to it, you just do an export as an MP3 file. And that's the way. And then once you make that MP3 file, which could be pretty big, depending on how large your music is, if you will, you then would put that somewhere that people could get to it. It's possible, I mean, depending on your encoding, it's possible that it'll be like 3.5 megs if it's like a 3-minute song. And if that's the case, you could theoretically email that to some people. They'll make sure that they have a fast dial-up, or that's going to be a nightmare for them, or fast internet connection. So what Drew's suggesting is just take that MP3 file and put it on some website.
I don't know about how .Mac works, but the traditional method for distributing files over a network or over the internet is called FTP, File Transfer Protocol. And you can set up a place like a website called an FTP site, which doesn't have all the fancy graphics and pictures, but it has a very simple directory structure, which is available to anyone on the internet, and they can just go there and click on the file and download it and listen to it.
Oh.
Your .Mac account, I believe, you can actually mount as a hard drive.
Drive,
a drive on your machine.
Yeah.
Didi, can you fill us in on how you use iDisk? Have you used it?
No, I haven't, because I don't have a .Mac account.
Okay.
So, Judith, that'd be my first recommendation is check your .Mac account and see if there's a way you can store files in an internet-accessible location.
If you're on your machine, just open up Help and do a search on iDisk and .Mac account stuff, and you'll get instructions on how to make your personal website, if you will.
Oh,
and it will walk you through pretty much all the steps necessary to do that.
And who's your ISP?
There's also ways for the rest of us to go from .Mac accounts.
I use AOL.
My friend introduced me to Dropload a while ago.
Sorry, Didi. Didi, go on.
Yeah. My friend introduced me to something called Dropload.com a while ago. She wanted to send me a short video of her dog in the snow. And so a couple minutes later, after I gave her my email address, I got an email that said, you should go to this website and download the video of Jarvis in the snow.
Okay, so what's the name of that service?
Dropload.com.
Yeah, so that's another solution, of course. Go to Dropload.com with your web browser and see the service they have. And basically, they're going to give you a web interface to upload files, and then you get a URL automatically, and it's a very simple process. It's going to be the easiest thing to do. I don't think it's paid. It's probably a free service.
Dropload is the place for you to drop your files off and have them picked up by someone else at a later time.
Okay. Pretty perfect.
There you go.
Files are removed from the system after 7 days, regardless if they've been picked up or not. You can upload any type of file, MP3, movies, docs, PDFs, up to 100 megabytes each.
And how do you make an iTunes file into an MP3 file?
I believe in iTunes, you do an export or save as. Try both of those.
Oh, export or save as.
Yeah, okay. look for an export first. That'll probably be the solution.
Okay.
The help will tell you. That's not a complicated thing.
Yeah, and it should be just a file under the file menu. It should be one of the choices, save as, or just try them both out and see if there's one that says MP3, and then you'll be set.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Judith, for the
call.
Thank you so much. We're going to go to... Let's see, where is Chris? Chris is in Santa Cruz. Chris, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Whoa.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, you're on.
Oh, excellent. Wonderful. I have a subject that I understand is one of Sean's favorites. It's about fans and cooling, and I guess when I heard the program before, I was tuning that out. Now I think I better tune that in. Some of your advice.
Get a little hot under the collar.
Well, I just got this program that monitors the temperature of my CPU, and it turned out that it was 480 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, my.
That's pretty hot. So I know.
Why did you install that program?
Pardon me?
Why did you install that program?
It can't be correct, because your processor would be a pile of
slag. Yeah. What prompted you to install that program, Chris?
I was reading on Langelist about fans and cooling and getting quieter fans and moving air around, and one of the suggestions was to get a software application which would monitor the CPU and the motherboard and then alert you if there was any problems.
The reason we're asking is that temperature is too hot. It wouldn't be functioning.
You would notice a serious performance problem, like smoke.
Yeah.
interesting.
Yeah, most processors are rated at about 80 degrees Celsius, but 100 degrees Fahrenheit, or 180 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like... Before they start,
that's
when they start cooking or stop working. So, most likely, this product is not so hot on detecting it. I actually didn't intend that pun, but what the heck. And the solution, by the way, what kind of machine? You have a Compaq or something?
I have a Compaq for Sario, yes.
Okay. I would personally, if you're not noticing a performance problem, I wouldn't really worry about it. The other thing you can do, did you add any equipment to this machine?
I have all sorts of things hanging off of it.
Okay,
yes.
Internally?
No.
Okay. Then probably nothing's wrong with your machine.
The factory spec is doing what it's designed to do, and you're fine.
It sounds like the software is not getting the information it needs from your BIOS.
Yeah. Go ahead, Lyle.
Do you have this box closed up? Correctly?
Yes, it is all closed up.
And all the ports where air could flow open, you don't have anything covering it?
I think I could probably improve my airflow.
Yeah, ideally, your front fan should blow into the case, and your back fan should blow out of the case. So you're moving air through, your computer front to back.
The other thing you can do, of course, some machines have filters with the fans.
Yeah.
If they do have filters, they'll clog up real quick.
Right.
Yank the filter and just throw it away, or clean the filter and put it back in. Make sure your machine's off, of course, when you play with the internals.
Okay, I think I can do that.
Yeah, but most chips are rated at 80 degrees Celsius, which is 176 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah,
I was getting all set to blow out all the dust bunnies and things.
Good.
When I saw this, because I just installed the software just a few minutes ago and got this alert.
It sounds like someone's trying to sell you something.
Who makes your motherboard?
What's Compaq?
I went in to try and find in system information who's making the motherboard, but I can't find any identifying information.
If it's Compaq, they probably do.
It's through
another manufacturer, yeah.
If you can get any information about the BIOS, like in the post, the power on self-test when it first starts up, it'll be a black screen with some white writing. Usually it flickers by pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's a way to pause that with some keystrokes, and you can read about the BIOS information. And if you go to the BIOS manufacturer, like AMI or Award or Phoenix or some of the older names, then they'll often have utilities that will diagnose the flavor of the BIOS and tell you what motherboard it is. And also, once you find the motherboard manufacturer, oftentimes they'll have a utility or a sensor. If the motherboard is capable of providing sensory information, the manufacturer will give you a software tool that'll analyze that data for you.
And you'll be able to trust that one. Another thought is the Compaq might have a flash screen that comes up first that says, like, Compaq when it's loading, and you can't see any of this stuff that Drew's talking about, the BIOS loading and the memory test and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to do some kind of escape to get to that screen. I don't personally know how to do that on a Compaq. Try the escape key. You could also do a search for entering BIOS on a Compaq. And basically, someone will have a whole thing on how you get into the BIOS setting. and part of that step will be see that screen.
Yeah.
The last thing is, if you're going to open up the box, you know, turn off everything, open up the box, don't unplug stuff, but look around, see if there's any filters to the fans and stuff, get the dust bunnies out of it. When you do that, take a look at the motherboard. There might be another name on the motherboard.
I doubt it.
Depending on how big the order, depending on how Compaq dealt with it, but it's possible you'll see another, the actual manufacturer, not just Compaq's name.
Your odds are pretty bad with the Compaq.
Yeah, unfortunately. Chris, thanks for calling in.
Can I ask one question that
is actually
kind of why I called?
Oh, please.
In the event that I do want to install any more fans in there just to keep things cool, I'm a little concerned that I don't really understand where to connect things up to.
Well, the Compaq's going to be pretty much set up the way it is. What you can do is get a better airflow fan in replace for one of the fans. But basically, take a look at the fans that are in there, and you'll see a cable coming off of it, two lines, a red and a black most likely, and it will connect to the motherboard to a certain spot. There'll be a connector there. And it should say on the motherboard, fan. If one of them says fan, or fan power, something like that, then the other ones will. Or it could not be connected to the motherboard. It could be connected to just the power from the power supply, and you'll just see that there'll be extras of those or not, and that's how you do it.
Right.
The thing is, the box is going to be defined. There'll be openings in the outside of the box, and there'll be fans at those openings. If there aren't fans at those openings, I mean, basically they designed the box to be a certain way. Compaq is going to be designed, you know, to work. It's not like a self-built machine.
Wait, what's the speed of your processor?
Let's see the speed. 2.133.
Yeah, that's not that hot. You don't really have to worry too bad. It's when you start getting to 2.53 plus gigahertz range, those chips run really hot.
But 2.3s run fast too. I mean, run hot too.
No, not as hot. Believe
not
it or not.
Not that hot. No. He's doing fine.
The other thing is, when you do open your machine up, definitely make sure that there's going to be a heat sink, a big heat sink on the machine that goes to the processor. Make sure the fan on top of that's functioning, and it's spinning well. Mm-hmm. And make sure when you do close it back up that you don't have any cables touching that, because that would be very bad.
There's a piece of software that's a free download. It's called BellArc Advisor.
Yes, I've got that.
You do? Mm-hmm. BellArc Advisor should give you pretty good information on the BIOS. If whatever there is to get, you can get it from BellArc.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, the problem with those pieces of software, there's got to be a temperature sensor underneath the processor.
That knows what it's doing.
And then you got to find the right software that can interface with that, you know, that thermometer, and basically find out what the temperature of the chip is. And, you know, I'd be surprised if Compaq put one of those on their board, because that adds cost.
Yeah.
From Monterey, we have a guy named Mac.
Hey, how are you today?
Hey, Mac. What's your problem today?
Question about a Trojan horse that I've got discovered on my spy route or whatever it was.
Okay.
And it quarantined it, and it's a Trader 21. And the only thing I've noticed is that the Windows is running slower to load up as far as your emails and so forth. And also, one of people on my email list did receive a Hive email that I did not send they could not open.
But you have a virus protection product that detected it and quarantined it?
Correct.
It shouldn't be affecting your machine anymore. But it's possible you have a different Trojan that your virus protection is not detecting.
Well, I ran it again and it didn't come up. So if it's quarantined, I don't have to worry about doing anything else
It means that one's been found and figured out. It's possible that prior to it being found and figured out, that's when the emails that you were sending out. Also, if someone gets a virus from potentially you through email, it doesn't necessarily mean your machine's doing that. It means that someone out there that has your email address's machine is affected. So it's not uncommon for people that have Mac accounts, for example, Mac machines that don't really get viruses of that nature, to think they're sending out viruses when actually they're not. Someone else is with their email addresses they reply to. So. Do you have Service Pack 2 installed?
Well, that's my next question. I didn't do it because I remember listening to you guys earlier on when it first was released to say wait for it, all the problems to shake out. So I wanted to ask, is it obviously a recommended thing to do at this point in time, and what should I do to prepare my machine before downloading it?
I would just do it. Make sure that your hard drive has enough space. You know, it's always a good thing to take a look at your hard drive space. If you go to My Computer open it up basically, how do you look for space? Right click on the hard drive.
On the drive letter.
Yeah.
And do properties.
Yeah.
And that should tell you how much space you have.
And make sure that you've got, you know, it's good to run Windows with like 2 gigs of space at least. If you're getting close to that, then you might run into problems soon. In any case, make sure you have enough space. Then go up to Windows Update with Internet Explorer, windowsupdate.microsoft.com, and follow the steps, and it'll prompt you to download this and install it. And I highly recommend at this point Service Pack 2. Only caveat to that is that you might run into a problem. But since you already have a problem, I would go with it.
Yeah.
Well, and what are the other downsides? I remember hearing you guys talk about it running slower or some complaints. Depends on the type of machine or how you loaded it up with the software, whether it was new or old. Or
I think at this point, from my perspective, is you got to do it. It's just time.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is slowly as you get new products, well, there's a lot of problems that Service Pack 2 addresses. It has better security, it has better firewall protection, it has better wireless support if you have a laptop.
Much better wireless support for laptop.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good things with it. And
if you have a tablet, you must get it.
Yeah, I would just do it.
Does it affect photo sending and Messenger and all that type of thing? Or?
Yeah, Messenger, you know, well, not Messenger. If you're using MSN Messenger, that thing will keep on working because they detect it. But other services of that nature where you're connecting in different ways to the Internet, like you know, if you're using Yahoo Instant Messenger or something like that, what will happen is when you install Service Pack 2, it's going to turn on the firewall automatically. And then whenever you're doing stuff of that nature, whenever you're connecting to the network with non-Microsoft products, basically, a little prompt's going to come up saying, this product is trying to service, you know, access the Internet. You just say, okay, accept, and learn that I want you to accept that.
Or,
and then it's
or deny it if you don't want information.
Or deny it if you don't want it to. Yeah.
I see.
So it gives you more control. I think
the positives far outweigh any of the negatives.
Yes.
It could be annoying, but only if you... if you ignored it.
Yeah.
If you ignore it, it's going to be annoying. It's going to keep coming back and asking you.
Right.
If you stop, take a moment and say, this is what I want you to do from now on, it won't bother you, at least
right.
with
All
that.
Right.
Thanks a lot for your help.
Thank you very much. All right. We're going to take a little bit of a guess, I believe. We're going to go with Templeton. Bill, welcome to GeekSpeak. Yeah, that's what I thought. All right. We're going to we're going to jump down and just take a guess somewhere. Let's see. Hey, Monterey Garland. Tony?
No.
Garland. Jim? Garland.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Hi, I have a question about... I have a PowerMac G3, blue and white, and it's got three hard drives in it. One is the original. Two are ones that I put in myself. It is having problems recognizing one of the two that I put in. It doesn't recognize anymore at all, and the other two it recognizes, but not immediately upon startup. It eventually
did this problem start happening when you put in a new drive or after you'd put in the drive?
This happened well after I put in the new drive. The three drives ran beautifully for a few years actually.
This is an odd one. Modding Macs isn't very common. So basically, you put two drives in there.
Mm-hmm.
The original is still functioning.
Yes.
And one of those drives, I'm assuming, you are connecting with the same line as the CD drive.
Yes.
Okay. So you've got it's IDE and the G3 is IDE drives.
Yes.
Normal parallel.
Does the primary IDE drive not have a second channel on it?
When you say a second channel, I'm not sure what you mean.
It does. I actually know the answer to that. Basically, what we're talking about is. Most Windows machines that have parallel IDE ATA have...
Oh, this is not a Windows...
No, I know. They have two channels, if you will, of IDE, primary and secondary, and both those have a master and a slave drive, basically meaning that... So your primary drive should be your first channel master, and that's
correct.
What Mac set up with. Correct. And then the other ones, as you plug them, you've got to select them to make sure that the one that shares the same bus with your... primary hard drive is on is in the slave setting and so on.
Yes, they're
so
both slaves.
You got all that working.
Wait. You said they're both slaves, Garland?
I mean, well, they are both set up. I mean, I did the switching properly.
The jumper set worked.
Good.
They would both be a slave because basically your primaries are going to be your original hard drive and your original CD. So the thought I'm having is a power. That'd be the one of the guesses is that it's possibly your power supply is kind of starting to slow down.
Okay.
But in general, this is not an easy thing to diagnose or fix, mostly because all the equipment that you could use to fix it is really expensive on a Mac platform.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, I don't have a good solution for you. You could try pulling one of the drives and seeing if the other drive is functioning, and then do that reversed. And if that happens, then it is a power problem. But the other thing you could do is take your drive and pull off your CD and do that. We're going to have to say goodbye to you. We're running out of time on GeekSpeak.
Okay.
But thank you very much, Garland, for the call.
Great. Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And anybody that's on the line, you're welcome to go to geekspeak.org and ask us through email. We didn't get to everybody. We never do. But we're here next week. You can call again. To wrap up the show a little bit, I want to talk briefly. I want to thank the geeks for being here, for Dee Dee for trying so hard and partially succeeding on joining the show from New York. Thank you. Drew, Meyer, thank you, and Sean Cleveland. And to my producer, Maggie Cleveland, I appreciate you being here every week, making sure this show runs smoothly. Technical problems are not Maggie's fault. Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. To all of you calling and calling in, joining the show, thank you very much for making Geek Speak what it is. Without your input, it'd just be us geeking out. Who wants to listen to that? This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Coming up next is The Open Road. At 1 p.m., Two Steps of the Blues with Charlie Lang. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KDBH San Arthur, on the web at kusp.org. The Geeks will be back next week. If you're interested in participating next week prior to, you're welcome to go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Fill that out, and we'll answer it next week's show, given time. For KUSP and Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell.